From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Author Sarah Gailey has written fantasy, science fiction, and mystery novels, short stories, and comics. Gailey has been a multi-year finalist for the Nebula, Hugo, and Locust Awards for Best Novella, and has received the Hugo and British Fantasy Awards. Gailey will appear with the Columbus Libraries Book Festival on July 11th and 12th. Welcome to Craft, Sarah Gailey.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm absolutely delighted to be talking to you today.
I'm very happy you're here, and I was looking over all of the cool stuff that you're doing. And when I went to your webpage, I saw that it has this splash page that in large font says, Sarah Gailey, fan of the human condition. It struck me because I'm more used to authors being, I don't know, critics of the human condition. So tell me about being a fan. Is this just positivity for people, or are there other things that you specifically have in mind for that?
Gosh, I wouldn't necessarily identify very strongly with positivity because the human condition contains so many highs and lows, yeah. And everything in between. This is something I've come to kind of over the course of my writing career and over the course of my life is an appreciation for the full breadth of what it means to be alive, which includes a lot of pain, a lot of sorrow. I think so many of us stand in a place of critique when it comes to pain and sorrow because we want to be able to find our way out of those experiences. But I think you're not alive if you're not feeling all of it. And so that fan of the human condition kind of sums that up. I appreciate it all for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Like you said, I don't know whether it's positivity or the embrace of the totality of humanity, but it is interesting to see a very different take than I'm maybe accustomed to people that write sci-fi, fantasy, and maybe a little dystopia in there. So very cool. So tell me about the origin story for your writing. How did you get started in this? You've got a lot of different genres that you're working in, and that is evidence of a lot of flexibility and talent. So what brought you into those genres?
Gosh, I mean, there are a few different ways to answer this question, and I used to answer it by talking about when I started writing professionally, but increasingly I'm thinking about my childhood. I grew up around books. My family were all avid readers. My mother worked at an independent bookstore and volunteered at our local library. So I spent a lot of time there. And it was just the background music of my life was books and reading and storytelling. And when I got older, as a teenager, I had this instant of thinking maybe I should be a writer when I grow up, the way that a lot of kids sort of try things on. I think 10 seconds after that, I said maybe I should be a lawyer, which would be an even worse idea. But as I grew up, I maintained a connection to art and storytelling, and mostly through theater, and then started exploring written stories through friends who were writing. Managed to find my way to finding the courage to try storytelling for myself. And I love it. I would never go back. I say pretty much every day, it's incredible that I get to do this as a job.
Mm-hmm. Even those times when you're stuck on a plot point and you have to go for a walk and wonder how you're going to resolve it, even then.
Yeah. Well, even then I say it's incredible that they let me do this for a job, but usually I'm saying something like, it's incredible they let me do this for a job, even though I'm terrible at it and I can't do it and it's never going to happen and it's a disaster. And usually that's around that point is when a friend of mine will say, time for a snack and a nap, and then you'll come back to it.
Just like when we were in kindergarten, you need that snack, the nap on the mat, and you're going to be right back in there.
Exactly. We haven't changed a bit out of people who like to say, oh, kids who need naps and snacks. And I'm like, I don't know. I've known a lot of you when you're hangry, and I keep snacks in the car just in case.
I can see that as a good thing as well. That does make a lot of sense. If we all had better access to snacks, we'd probably all be a little bit happier.
Absolutely. So,
in your recent publication, Make Me Better, the protagonist, Celia, wants a sense of belonging. So she goes to Kindred Cove for its annual Salt Festival, which promises healing and transformation and, importantly, no grief. But before we discuss the book, I'd like to read the foreword because it really struck me. To love is to accept a future that contains grief. The grief may be ours, or it may belong to those we leave behind. To love a child, or a partner, or a dream, or a community, is to enter into a contract with the inevitable pain of loss. This is a book about what pain we will accept and inflict on others to avoid the contract. It is about the paths we take to evade the inevitable. Tell me about the background of the foreword, because I think it says a lot about your book and the themes of grief that you're exploring in the book.
Thank you. I'm so glad that it connects for you. Coming to this foreword was really interesting because Make Me Better is a book that includes a lot of depictions of violence and loss, and specifically some forms of violence and loss that are very difficult for certain people to read about. I believe in the importance of people knowing what kind of party they're coming to when they engage with a piece of media. I think it will give people a bad time if they show up to a book expecting it to be, for example, a fun romantasy, and then what they get is an exploration of intimate partner violence in a very explicit way. They're just not going to be in the mindset to appreciate the art they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so I find that to be sort of at war within me with this desire to trust and challenge readers. I believe that readers are capable of so much. And I think the best art is art that asks readers to come with it and be challenged and seek growth within themselves through the art. And this kind of conflict inside of me comes to a head with the question of content warnings. I think it's very important to respect people's desire to not have specific traumas activated through media in a way that will harm their nervous systems. I have post-traumatic stress disorder, and so I very intimately know the genuine physical harm that I can come to if the wrong thing happens to my nervous system. My body will be hurt as a result. And at the same time, I'm inclined to treat people as adults who can put a piece of media down and walk away from it if they recognize it's going to cause them harm. So from that question came this foreword. This foreword is my way of saying to the reader, here's the kind of party you're invited to. It is not going to be an easy one, and it's going to be a complicated one, but it's one that I think you should attend. And the specific concept is one that I came to through the writing of this book, through the research that I did, and the extensive iterative editing process. I came to a very real belief that grief is one of the most unavoidable human experiences. It is one of the most universal human experiences. It is the most painful emotional human experience. And it's the one that we will go to the greatest lengths to avoid. I've really observed in the years that I've spent writing and editing this book, the things people will do to wound themselves and the people around them in the name of not having to experience grief. Something that I really deeply want my readers to come away from this book considering is what they will do to avoid grief.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of what you have in mind there? Because I was thinking about that when it said in the quote that we will inflict on others to avoid the contract, which I think is the same thing you're getting at here. But what have you seen that you would point to and say, I think this is somebody trying to avoid grief? Is it when people just don't enter in fully into relationships? Or is there something else you have in mind there?
I mean, that's a huge one, right? People avoiding close relationships, close friendships, mm-hmm. emotional intimacy in their partnerships can come from a fear of the pain that will come when that partnership goes away. I know people who have wanted to have children but chosen not to out of the fear of what it might feel like if something happened to their child. I know many people who are very afraid to fully explore their own identities. There's something that someone very wise told me once, which is every time we say yes to one thing, we say no to something else. And saying no to something comes with grief. And there are so many people out there who are afraid to become the person they most truly are because it would mean saying no to the person they've been. Mm-hmm. And the grief of saying no, maybe I'm not this thing that I've my whole life been working really hard to try and be, to try to convincingly be, to try to seem like. If I accept that I'm not that thing I've been trying to be, then I have to sit with the grief of losing all that effort, of maybe the change that will come in relationships in my life as a result of me being the person I truly am. People are really afraid of that grief. And when you're sitting in the fear of grief, it's almost impossible, I think, to see how worth it that grief can be, because it comes with a fullness of self. And with, again, that full human experience that is not shut down or living a half life, but instead living a full life that is allowed to include some pain.
Yeah, I've heard it referred to as grief is the price of love. Yeah, I understand what you're getting at. And I've had that sort of experience as well, multiple times. So that was why it stood out to me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that grief is both the price of love and I think is an expression of love. I think of grief as being love that doesn't have a place to anchor itself to anymore. And I'm sure I'm not the first person with this thought. I probably saw some piece of writing or piece of art that installed that in my mind, but unfortunately I don't know where I saw it, so I can't credit whatever smarter person than I came up with that. But when love has a place to anchor to, it's this powerful feeling, right? It's transformative. It's incredible. And then when that anchor point goes away, we're surprised that it's still an incredibly powerful emotion that changes us even further.
Was Make Me Better difficult, or maybe a more difficult book to write, because you were taking on really difficult topics? Or was it a sense of freedom because you could take on the topic?
Oh gosh, it was so hard. This book is easily the most difficult book I've ever written. It almost made me quit writing. It was so, so challenging, both because of the themes. They're complicated and they're multitudinous and very messy, right? This is not a book about simple emotions. And it's also structurally very challenging. There's a lot of characters with a lot of different perspectives, and all of those needed to get balanced in this quite complicated narrative. Mm-hmm. So I spent about 6 years writing and rewriting it. And every time that I rewrote it, I rewrote the whole thing. It was the entire book, top to bottom. And every time I rewrote it, I discovered something new that the book was trying to say. And then I would have to go back and look at everything that every character did and thought and felt throughout the book and see where I had been hiding from what the book was trying to say. Mm-hmm. And then reveal what actually needed to be discussed in that moment. Yeah. It was so hard. I hope I'd never write a book this difficult again.
Everything from now on is going to be unicorns and rainbows.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe to raise it up a little bit, because we've been a little bit heavy. You've also written for Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes.
What was it like entering into an established and beloved series like that?
Oh, gosh, it was so fun. I mean, Buffy was not my first time writing for established media, but I had not written something so extensive and with such freedom. When I took on Buffy, the editors told me, we're basically doing like a sort of a multiverse thing, so you can do an alternative storyline. You can change a lot of stuff and write with a lot of freedom. And I had the incredible thrill of getting to approach this universe from a perspective of, okay, what would I have to say if I was a writer in this world? And it was so fun. And I have to tell you, Buffy fans are the best. I've written, as I said, for various different intellectual properties, and some fandoms are friendlier than others. Mm-hmm. And the Buffy fandom has been the most welcoming, thoughtful, excited, enthusiastic group. I think in part because Buffy fans aren't afraid of difficult conversations. The originator of the work is someone who there have had to be a lot of difficult conversations around. He is someone who has hurt a lot of people, and people who love his work have had to reckon with that impact.
Yeah.
And as a result, when you talk to them about complicated emotional issues, they're like, yeah, let's go. Let's talk about the complicated stuff. Let's explore all the corners of what people can be to each other. And also, like, let's fight some vampires. And it's so much fun and so freeing.
Yeah, that's fascinating to hear, because I've talked to other people who were doing things under contract, and they're like, well, they brought me a binder of stuff that I'm not allowed to do. And it's interesting that you got the freedom for that. I would kind of wonder, because I was a Buffy fan from the beginning. I even saw it in the theater. That's how old and geeky I am. I was like, okay, if you have a moment like that where you can do anything, okay, are you going to bring Tara back? What are you going to do? You're going to bring your mom back. What's all going to happen? Because there were so many characters that died in the show. You've got a field of things to play in. It's wonderful to hear that you had that freedom.
I will say, on other properties I've worked on, I have received the binder. And sometimes the binder just comes in the form of, be aware of the censorship board. Because they're major IP holding US companies who have teams of lawyers, and those lawyers' entire job is to review the work that I write and determine who and where might sue them for anything. And oh my gosh, some of the notes that I've gotten back have been like, I got one that I obviously can't say what property it was for, but I was putting a character in a motorcycle jacket, and I put something on the motorcycle jacket that would be like a fun inside joke for the fans, right? And the note that I got back was, we can't use this because we don't know all the logos and iconography of every chapter of the Hell's Angels, and they may be litigious if we infringe on their trademark.
I guess the litigiousness of the Hell's Angels is the least of your concerns.
I mean, listen, the last thing I want is to do anything at all to offend the Hell's Angels. I will always try to stay on their good side, I suppose. Right.
Okay, and that's what I'm going to call this episode, Sarah Gailey, staying on Hell's Angels' good side. Thank you very much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it, and we're looking forward to you being in Columbus at the Columbus Library's wonderful book festival on July 11th and 12th. Sarah Gailey, thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you so much.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.